from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. With the January 1st fiscal cliff looming, Washington is looking for more revenue, less spending, debating cuts and hikes and what they now like to call breaks, tax breaks, and not just for fat cats. What could go? Your deductions on home mortgage interest, state income taxes, employer-paid health insurance, and more. Tax breaks that most of us assumed we were due as Americans. This hour on Point, we look at potentially big cuts in tax breaks and what that could mean for you. You can join the conversation. Do these sound like breaks, like loopholes, or like your American birthright? Do you see what's coming? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Washington is the Washington Post's Lori Montgomery, who's been closely following the negotiations over the fiscal cliff. Lori, thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So what Erskine Bowles said yesterday, 1 in 3 chance of a deal by January 1st? Does it look that dim, grim to you?
You know, we're going to need Prozac by the time this is over. Sort of a roller coaster. It depends on who you talk to. Yesterday, I talked with one very high-ranking senior Democrat on the Senate side who said, things are going to start to happen and more than you think. And then I talked to somebody else, and they said, we're going over the cliff. So,
Who's going to do the deal if there is a deal done, Lori? Where is it going to happen?
It has to be done between the White House and House Speaker John Boehner. Those are the two poles of this negotiation, and you know, we sort of know what the poles of their discussions are, which is what do we do with the tax rates in 2013 to get us to tax reform next year, and what do we do with entitlement programs, which are the biggest spending problem we have.
So let's go to taxes first and tax rates. I mean, I'm reading reports coming out now saying, and we've heard the dam breaking maybe or cracking a little bit this week on this, but people saying there are going to be tax rate hikes of some kind. Does that sound credible to you? Is the Republican hard line on that in the House shaking?
I think that's almost certain to happen. I mean, I can't see the Democrats in Congress as well as in the White House are so buoyed by the election results. They cannot cave on this. They can't stay with 35%. They're going to need something. And they've said that they're willing not to go. The president himself has told Erskine Bowles, who told us yesterday, that the president doesn't need to go all the way up to 39.6%, which is where the top rate would go when the Bush tax cuts expire in January. But they're going to need something.
Okay.
So if the Republicans can't give at least 37% or something like that, I can't imagine that we don't throw this into January.
Republicans and more talk a lot about closing loopholes or tax breaks. And when you sort that out, it seems to come down to deductions that people are pretty accustomed to in this country. We're going to talk about that today. But what about that end of the equation, Lori?
Yeah, so loopholes and special interest tax breaks are the words that people use when they don't want to say your child credit
right.
And your home mortgage deduction, because that's what they're talking about. I mean, there's no way to get $800 billion over the next 10 years out of tax, you know, deductions and tax breaks without targeting some pretty big things. And the biggest things are middle-class things. It's the tax-free treatment of the health insurance you get from your employer, and it's your mortgage interest deduction, and it's charitable contributions, and it's the child credit you get. It's $1,000 right now for every child you have. So this is not special interest stuff.
Are people fighting over that, or is it now assumed some of those will go away as part of a deal?
Well, to be honest with you, I don't think we've gotten to that fight yet, because right now the question is, where do we set the tax rates in 2013 while we do tax reform? Because everybody agrees tax reform will not happen until next year. We can't do it before January. So the fight over deductions and such is a next year problem. But yes, I mean, I think that a lot of interest groups are starting to get very anxious about what's coming once we get past this initial phase.
So the actual hammering out details of the fight would be next year, but some kind of agreement to do it, you're suggesting, is likely to be part of what's in front of us right now.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that we've got to get some resolution of the Bush tax cuts. Do we extend them all? Do we extend them partially? Do we extend them only for the middle class? And then the second part of a likely deal will be, and once we let this happen, we're also going to get $1.2 trillion out of tax reform over the next 10 years. So that pushes us into tax reform, and there's likely to be some kind of agreement about how you approach tax reform. You know, the money has to come primarily from the wealthy, for example. Democrats will insist on that. You know, maybe you'll see something along the lines of, and we'll try to do it primarily by capping deductions at a certain amount. I mean, that is also a bipartisan proposal. The president himself has suggested a limit on itemized deductions at the top of the income spectrum. Mm-hmm. So people at the top are almost certainly going to lose a segment of the deductions they've been accustomed to taking. The question really becomes, like, how far down into the middle class does this start to reach, or can they limit it really to the pinnacle of the income spectrum?
We're going to look at that in this hour, Lori. And finally, what about the odds of nothing happening, of just things freeze up and over the cliff or whatever you want to call it, we go? Is that a real possibility? Everybody says, no, it can't happen, but could it?
I think today it is a real possibility. I think that possibility gets much, much less the closer we get to the reality of, you know, midnight December 31st. Because these guys, you know, as they did with the debt ceiling battle in 2011, they've proven to us again and again that it is often too early to make a deal. And so the unthinkable is thinkable until we get too close to it, and then it's not thinkable
We're
anymore.
Thinking
so.
The unthinkable, unthinkable, thinkable. Lori Montgomery with The Washington Post, thank you so much for the update. Thanks for joining
us. Thanks for having me. Uh-huh.
Deductions, loopholes, they are in the conversation. Here was President Obama, November 14th, news conference at the White House, saying the first step is to deal with the Bush tax cuts. But then listen, loopholes, deductions.
What we can then do is shape a process whereby we look at tax reform, which I'm very eager to do. I think we can simplify our tax system. I think we can make it more efficient. We can eliminate loopholes and deductions that have a distorting effect on our economy.
Republicans all about that. Here was Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania telling CNN Tuesday he could stomach a reduction in tax breaks if it means keeping marginal tax rates down.
If we're going to have to have some kind of revenue increase, which this president seems determined to do, I would hope we could at least do it in the way that does the least economic harm. That means lower marginal rates, reform the tax code, offset the lost revenue by reducing the deductions and write-offs and loopholes and that sort of thing. Then at least you could hope that you'd have some pro-growth policy in your tax code that would offset the damage done by greater revenue.
Republican Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania there talking reducing deductions and write-offs and loopholes. This may come closer to home than you have imagined. Joining us right now from Washington is Robertson Williams, senior fellow with the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. He worked at the Congressional Budget Office from 84 through 06, most recently as deputy assistant director for tax analysis. Bob Williams, thanks very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom.
And from Washington, Diane Lim is here, chief economist at the Concord Coalition, an advocacy group that promotes an end to deficit spending. She was chief economist for the House Budget Committee from 07 to April 08. You can link to her blog at our website, onpointradio.org. Diane Lim, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom, and hi, Bob.
Great to have you both. Bob, first to you, what do you see as being on the table, big picture, in these negotiations when it comes to what's now being called tax breaks?
Well, I think as Lori pointed out, there are all the things that are on the table, some of the ones that we really grown accustomed to, the mortgage interest deduction, state and local tax deduction, even the charitable contribution seems to be up for grabs, but I expect that one will be pushed off the table pretty quickly. The problem is there's real money there, but you have to go after a lot of different things to get enough cash to cover the lower rate that Republicans would like to have.
So, I mean, Mitt Romney talked a lot about this, but never wanted to give the details. That was politically costly for him. Do we see any more details now, or do you expect, as Lori was saying, that there'd be some kind of broad agreement to go after deductions, write-offs, so-called loopholes, tax breaks, and then details to follow?
Well, it's really hard to tell right now because everything's going on behind closed doors. We're not hearing much of anything, and I don't think we will hear anything until there's a deal made. There'll be a lot of activity on the outside, interest groups saying, don't do this, don't do that, pushing for themselves to be protected. But I don't think we're really going to see what the deal is until it actually comes to fruition.
Diane, if we
if we're moving towards some kind of a deal, it's murky. I don't know, but you're from the deficit hawk camp. Do we have to cut back on deductions, in your view, and maybe down into the middle class to make a real difference in the deficit the federal government's running?
Well, I think it's very clear that in order to achieve the kind of deficit reduction that we're all talking about we need to do over the next 10 to 20 years, we're going to have to raise more revenue. It can't be just spending side solutions. And, you know, the question you raise is there enough base broadening that we can actually do? I mean, I think mathematically, technically, we could do it. Politically is the big question. And that's why I think that the approaches that Lori mentioned that are sort of across the board reductions in the value of these tax, so-called tax expenditures, are going to be the way to go, because if you pick on particular tax preferences, you know, the lobbying groups, there's a lobbying group for every one of those large tax expenditures, and they would never put up with their preference being picked on and not and everyone else getting away without any increased burden.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about everyday so-called tax breaks on the chopping block in the fiscal cliff negotiations. Home mortgage deductions, insurance deductions, deductions for state, local income tax, and how losing them might affect the national budget and you. Some people in Washington saying, no, don't touch those. A lot of people saying they're going to be touched. Just how deeply, we'll see. Here was Democratic Senator Harry Reid on the Senate floor Tuesday defending deductions.
An agreement to avoid the fiscal cliff must give economic certainty to middle-class families. It must protect important tax deductions for families and businesses still struggling to recover from this great recession.
But even the president's talking about going after loopholes, tax breaks. Here's Republican Representative Diane Black of Tennessee, member of the Budget Committee, telling CNN yesterday she's ready to cut tax breaks.
We would have a plan where we would have pro-growth tax reform, and that means something fairer, flatter, and simpler. And a portion of that is to look at the deductions that right now really do benefit those in the upper income.
We've got a couple of pros who really know this terrain with us this hour. Diane Lim is here from the Concord Coalition Advocacy Group promoting an end to deficit spending, the deficit hawk here. Robert and Bob Williams is with us from the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. And Diane, Bob, if I may, I mean, we've got lots of response to this already. You know, but here are people saying online, Greg says, why on earth call them tax breaks? People are pretty accustomed to these things, Bob, as kind of bedrock of their financial planning. They're you know, the things taxes don't touch, 401k breaks and all the rest.
But it's certainly been the case that people have built in the mortgage interest deduction to their calculations. How much can they afford to pay for a house? And they're relying on that tax savings as part of the deal in buying the house. People who give money to charities are taking into account the fact that they'll be able to deduct that on their tax returns.
And this goes deep, right? This is churches and synagogues and you name it.
Across the board.
Museums, everything. Mm-hmm.
But the point made by one of the clips you had, that these benefit the high-income people, is absolutely true. That most of the value of itemized deductions goes to high-income folks for three reasons. One, they're much more likely to itemize. Only 30% of us itemize, and most of those are the wealthier people.
Okay.
Two, rich people itemize a lot more than lower-income people, middle-income people. And three, they save a lot more on their taxes for every dollar they itemize. They say if you're in the 35% tax bracket, you save 35 cents for each dollar you itemize. If you're in the 15% bracket, you only save 15 cents. So that's heavily weighted towards the top end, and cutting these is very progressive. At the same time, it does hit middle and lower-income households that do itemize and could be a bad thing for them.
So, Diane, help me understand, if it goes after higher-income Americans, if this would hit them harder, why is it that Republicans have been so dead set against a marginal tax rate hike, but apparently quite open to going after these deductions that, you know, you'd think it's the same people that would get hit either way, and a lot of those likely Republicans?
Well, Republicans are focused on encouraging supply-side economic growth. So when they talk about you can't let taxes on the rich go up because it'll kill job creation that's going on right now, they're in a way mixing up what is a longer-term concern about supply-side economic growth with a short-term concern, which is we still need to stimulate demand in this economy. When it comes to tax cuts, you know, basically who gets the tax cut matters in terms of how effective it is as stimulus. And so the irony in all of this debate is we're talking about avoiding the fiscal cliff, which is basically avoiding tax increases. And we want to avoid that right now because we want to keep creating jobs. But the most effective tax cut in terms of creating jobs and through stimulating demand is actually the payroll tax cut that's about to expire.
Mm-hmm.
But no one's really debating whether that tax cut should be extended. Everyone's focused on the Bush tax cuts and, in particular, the high-end Bush tax cuts. When those are really – the Congressional Budget Office has shown that those are really the least stimulative to the short-term economy. So it's – there's a lot of confusion in the town, and maybe some of it's intentional, which is that Republicans in general are going to prefer low tax rates on high-income households because there is an incentive effect of tax rates in terms of affecting people's willingness to work or to save. But that is a concern that's not so great right now as great as it will be maybe in a couple years when the economy's back to full employment.
I want to run down the list of breaks that could go away in this, but let me put the same question to you, if I may, Bob, and through here a listener writes to us and says, what's the difference between closing tax loopholes or breaks versus raising tax rates? If both mean paying more in taxes, why are Republicans so much more keen on closing loopholes over raising rates? What do you say to that, Bob?
It makes a difference in who pays how much more. If you lose the benefit of the mortgage interest deduction, for example, that hits only people who have mortgages and itemize those deductions. Whereas if you raise rates, it's going to hit everybody who's subject to the rates you increase.
But it's the top rate that's been most controversial, and that would hit the same people. That would hit the higher-income people.
Right. Well, a lot of the people at the very high end don't have mortgages. A lot of the people at the high end benefit from charitable contributions. You want to take that away, fine. But we've shown that that would very likely reduce a lot of the very large contributions that benefit various institutions, schools, universities.
Charities of all kinds, yeah.
All the charities, but particularly the larger contributions. Those are the ones that would be most affected. It really depends on what you want to do. As Diane pointed out, the tax rates are more likely to affect people's behavior in general. The tax preferences, the breaks, affect particular kinds of behavior. Sometimes they do what we want them to do, sometimes they don't. The mortgage interest deduction doesn't seem to increase the number of people who own houses. It just encourages us to buy bigger houses and pay more money for them.
But if this whole preference is in some significant part just to help people who don't even have a mortgage, you're getting way up the income scale at that point.
Oh, yes. Now, the key with deductions is they help you only if you can deduct if you have the expense to deduct, and if you then have enough of that expense to make it worth itemizing rather than taking the standard deduction. That's why high-income people are much more likely to itemize. They have more expenses,
yeah.
And for them it's worth something to itemize. Take it away, and they're the ones that are going to hit hardest, but not all of them will be hit equally. Things hit differentially depending on what your particular economic situation is.
Boy, it's something to get in the middle of this here. At some point, this is going to be hammered out. A lot of it behind closed doors. We're trying to sort of peer in there to see what the logic might be or the interests at work. Bob, Diane, stand by. Tracy's calling from Pawtucket, Rhode Island. Tracy, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Great. Thank you. Great show, Tom. I love your show.
Thank you.
Enjoy it greatly. I just want to make one point that the mortgage rate reduction is very important to many middle-class individuals. And for me, it benefits me, at least puts me forward $3,000.
Yeah, every year. Yeah.
Yes, so it's much larger than they're speaking about, and it certainly doesn't only benefit the upper class. And really, it does give us the incentive to itemize.
Right.
And many people who buy property, sometimes they're not aware of that benefit, but when they do, after a year concludes, they realize what a benefit it is. And my value of my home has decreased greatly. This is one of the most significant benefits to me.
And is it a benefit to you as middle class, rich, lower, upper? Where do you fall,
middle
Tracy?
Middle class, definitely middle class.
Right in the middle. Let us pick that one up. I mean, Diana, Bob, lots of people writing about this. Jim writes to us along the same lines as Tracy says, if they mess with the mortgage interest deduction, they will destroy the middle class, would cause the housing market to falter. It's barely recovering. He says, I prefer to have personal income tax hike across the board, be fair to everyone. What do you say, Bob?
I think there's a lot of sense to what Jim has to say, and Tracy's point is exactly right. People do make this calculation when they buy houses. If you don't know it yourself, your realtor will point it out to you. So that it's not exactly a big secret.
Right.
But what it does is it boosts housing prices. We need to phase it in so that people like Tracy won't be harmed right away. But over time, we might want this to disappear. The problem is, the longer we take to phase it out, the less revenue we get from it, the less effect we have today. That, from some perspectives, is actually a good thing. As Diane pointed out, we don't really want to have a big tax increase on the economy right now when we're still weak. So phasing it in might actually be a good way to deal with things. But that doesn't solve the issue right now. The big battle here in Washington is over how much we're going to cut the deficit. How much do we do on spending side, cutting spending? How much do we do by raising revenues? There are targets out there, and we have to bring enough money in by the combination of those two factors.
Yeah, Diane, I mean, this is kind of an unimaginable conversation very recently. Can you picture, let's just take the mortgage income deduction, the interest income interest deduction. Can you picture that passing? I can just imagine the kind of realtor, you know, phalanx
right.
of realtor lobbyists lined up when this gets down to the nitty-gritty. Can you really picture this going through?
Well, I'm going to reassure everyone who's listening that the mortgage interest deduction is not going to go away. I can almost guarantee you that. I don't think either side of the aisle is talking about eliminating these tax preferences. I think what everyone's trying to at least start to discuss is the idea that a lot of these tax preferences just cost a tremendous amount of money. And the question is, they obviously provide benefits to people, but are those benefits worth that cost? I think all the proposals that are being seriously considered are not eliminating specific tax preferences, but limiting them, and limiting them in ways that you preserve the full value that's currently enjoyed by middle-class households and only reduce the value of these preferences for high-income households. So that's the good news. The other thing to keep in mind is that
that's the capping kind of path.
Right. And I think that that's the most promising route in this idea of base broadening. The other thing to remember is that we do have a lot of room to raise tax rates in various kinds of ways, and including one of the easiest ways is to just let current law take effect, if not this year, maybe eventually over the next, you know, 2 or 3 years, to phase back to the pre-Bush tax cuts tax rates. That, by the way, is more revenue than anyone is talking about raising as part of a grand bargain. So that's the easiest way, because we've done it before. It's already in current law. All we'd have to do is temporarily extend some of the tax rates or all of the tax rates or something in between current law and current policy, and then let them expire after another period of time and get back to current law tax rates.
Bob, are you equally confident that when all is said and done, the middle class is going to be protected once we get into trimming back on these tax preferences or tax breaks? Or is the need for revenue, the need to balance such that the temptation is going to be great to go down and, you know, hit people a little lower and a little lower in the income scale?
No, I do think Diane is right. And the reason for that is the president for the last 5 years, ever since he started campaigning for the presidency in 2007, has said he does not want to raise taxes on the middle class. He's going to protect 98% of the population from tax increases and impose all his tax increases on that top 2%. He's going to continue to battle for the middle class, and I don't think he's going to agree to any compromise that hits the middle class very hard at all. And doing it through the mortgage interest deduction, doing it through state and local tax deduction, through the charitable contribution, he would not do that. As Diane points out, if you put a cap on it, you're protecting most middle-income households. Few people would be hit. Those who have very
In other words,
high.
You could have the deduction up to, and we've seen different numbers flying around, total deductions that might hit, what, 17 or 20 or 30 or higher.
Right. The problem, of course, is the higher you set that cap, the less revenue you get.
Right.
You eliminate all deductions and leave rates where they are right now. We estimate that would bring in $2.2 trillion in the next 10 years. That's more than anybody's asking for in the current negotiations.
Okay.
If you set the cap at $25,000, you bring in about $1.3 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
That's almost what the president wants to get in total.
And how far down the income scale would that go? That would hit zillionaires, obviously. Would it hit people with household incomes of, I don't know, 100, 80?
It will hit some people down low in the income scale. Their households, elderly households, for example, who have $50,000 or $60,000 income, but they're experiencing very large medical expenses that they're paying out of savings.
Right.
If you're in a nursing home, you may well be paying very high amounts. You can deduct that, and that's a big deal for those
people.
You
can deduct it now, but
you can deduct it now, and you probably could, depending on how they set it up. But those would be the people who would be hit by a cap. More likely, I think, is going to a cap around $50,000. That would bring in about $750 billion over 10 years, about half of what the president is looking for. You combine that with a smaller rate increase, you may get exactly what you want.
A $50,000 cap, and that would hit households likely with incomes of like what, Bob?
Most of it would hit households that are above the $200,000 range, but there will be households at lower levels who would be hit. It's a scattershot thing, depending so much on particular circumstances.
Right, but that's what we're into here. Omaha, Nebraska, Aaron's calling. Hi, Aaron, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. You and your guests have been mentioning child care credits, mortgage deductions. These are all middle-class benefits. But I'm wondering, why aren't we ever discussing carried interest or pass-throughs? I mean, are these things actually a myth? During the election, it seemed like the Republicans were saying that they despise favoritism in the tax code.
Right.
But if you were to suggest doing away with, you know, carried interest, like the Republican presidential candidate was benefiting from,
right,
they would scream bloody murder. And I'm wondering, why don't we talk about that as one way to raise more revenue?
Aaron, I'm glad for that question. Bob, how about it? I mean, carried interest, you know, hedge fund guys, doing very well with that kind of tax structure. What about that? I mean, for that matter, what about the lower capital gains rates that we saw in recent years? Many people include those on lists of tax breaks. What about the real things that sound like fat cat loopholes, not middle class loopholes?
Well, I think the caller is absolutely right. If you want to target very high income people, there are specific things you can go after that benefit them very explicitly. The lower rates on capital gains and dividends, 95% of this tax savings go to people in the top fifth of the income distribution, and more than half the benefits go to people in the top one-tenth of 1%, people with incomes over $2.2 million a year. They get more than half the tax savings because they have a lot of income of that sort, and they save a lot with the lower rates.
Yep.
So raising those rates would make a lot of sense. I think you'd find a lot of objection to that, though. It'd be very difficult to get that past the Republican Party. And if you can't get things past the Republicans, it's not going to happen. Carried interest, it's certainly worth going after, but there's not a lot of money there, about $5 billion a year at best. And
so there'd be more about equity than actual dollars there.
Exactly. Fairness. And there are a lot of things in the tax code we'd like to get rid of on a fairness basis. That's something that we ought to be looking at down the road. I don't think it's going to happen in the short-term negotiations between now and the end of the year.
Let's go to Ben in Girard, Illinois. Ben, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom, Bob, Diane.
Hi.
I'm middle income, but I'm beginning to see the wisdom of actually going over this cliff and feeling the pain. I mean, losing something like the mortgage interest deduction would be painful for me, but it seems like, you know, social change in this country has been long delayed, and something like this that might cause some pain might spur change and might, you know, to continue the cliff metaphor, we might find out that some of us have wings and we can, you know, sustain this, and other things might not. And this might be the type of uncomfortability that could spurn some action and change.
I'm sure politicians are listening very closely to voices like yours, Ben. I mean, Bob, what about it? Do you see all the talk about deficits and throwing things up in the air, the sort of take the medicine attitude? Is it big enough that people feel an opportunity now to do things that they've never done before?
Well, there's a group called, referred to as the cliff divers, who think going over the cliff is a good idea. From a political perspective, it might be good because then you're talking about cutting rates to get down, and it might be a lot easier to come to some sort of an agreement on how to get less tax increase than we would otherwise have.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about everyday tax breaks on the chopping block in the fiscal cliff negotiations, home mortgage interest deductions, insurance deductions, deductions for state, local income taxes, and how losing them might affect the national budget, might affect you. Robertson Bob Williams is with us from the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center in Washington. Diane Lim is with us from the Concord Coalition, chief economist there. I'd like to just kind of walk down through what's now being characterized as tax breaks or tax expenditures or loopholes to see what could happen here. I mean, Bob, if I may come to you on, you know, employee-sponsored health insurance. A lot, I think 60% or something of Americans get their health insurance through their employers with a big subsidy there that is not currently taxed. That is now being characterized as a tax break. What might happen there, Bob?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. That is one of the things that's on the chopping block. It is a very large break. It has historical basis because of price and wage controls during World War II. But it doesn't make sense to not tax that form of compensation. People who get it as part of their pay are getting a big tax break. People who don't are getting nothing out of it, and they have to go out and buy their own policies on their own with no tax break at all, to speak of. So it's a big thing to get out of there. The problem is, as you say, 60% of us rely on our employers to provide the health insurance that we have right now,
mm-hmm.
and raising the cost of that would be a big hit on the Americans. Very likely the way to deal with it will be something like a cap, saying up to a certain point we'll let you have it for free, but after that, if you have a very expensive policy, we'll start making a taxable income. Question is, where do you set that? How many people are you going to hit? The caps that I've heard about would hit an awful lot of families because it's very expensive to provide health insurance for a family.
So, down into middle-class ranks, you're suggesting?
Certainly we get down there because the middle class benefits very greatly from getting those insurance policies through their employment.
What about the exclusion of employer pension benefits, tax-free earnings on 401ks and that kind of thing?
Again, that's something that encourages people to save for retirement. There is some evidence that that is true. People do save more than they otherwise would. And we know that people are not saving enough for retirement. So doing something that would discourage savings is not a good thing to do in a long-term policy perspective. That said, it benefits wealthy individuals much more than lower middle-class individuals because the wealthy are going to save every penny they can possibly save. They've got enough money to save, and they're saving beyond these tax-favored accounts. We're giving a very large tax break to the wealthy and not getting relatively similar benefits to the middle class. So do we want to do this kind of thing? Well, again, a cap might make sense. If you say we're going to let you have a certain amount that's not subject to tax, and then we'll go after the rest. But it's very hard to pull these pieces together in the short time we have left this year.
What about deduction of state and local income taxes? Lots of people pay those, different rates in different states, a few with none. But is that also in this basket of potential targets, Bob?
It's one of the very likely targets because it is fairly big. The basic argument for it is it makes it cheaper for state and local governments to tax their citizens. The citizens are willing to put up higher tax rates at state and local level because they know they'll be saving on their federal taxes as a result. But again, it benefits high-income people more than low- and middle-income people. They're the ones that pay the higher taxes and most likely to be able to itemize and therefore benefit. Taking that away would be a hit on the state and local governments, but again, it's likely to be one of the things on the chopping block high on people's lists.
Just how much of this we might see, the big question, as you say. This was on ABC's This Week on Sunday. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham and Democratic Senator Dick Durbin talked about the fiscal cliff, and Durbin defended the Democratic tax plan, said, hold off on cutting into those deductions. Let's listen.
I think the top rate needs to go up, and that's where I may disagree with my friend Lindsey Graham. Remember during the course of the presidential debate how many times the president turns to Mitt Romney and said, well, do the arithmetic. How in the world are you going to reduce deductions and generate enough revenue for meaningful deficit reduction? He could never answer the question because there is no reasonable answer to it.
Well, okay, Diane, we did see Mitt Romney really push and say, look, he said bring down tax rates and then get rid of loopholes and deductions, and he didn't want to specify those. This conversation kind of clues us into why. Those get very personal in a hurry, and people may get their backs up. But you're with an outfit that just keeps doing the numbers. On the big picture here, do we have to do both? Do we have to have higher taxes and fewer deductions, Diane?
I do think we're headed for a combination of both rate increases and reduced tax preferences, these tax breaks. I think that the problem is that there's really not enough base broadening that can be done that both sides of the aisle are willing to embrace and subject the American people to support low rates. One very important example, a lot of politicians cite the Simpson-Bowles proposal, the President's Fiscal Commission's proposal that allowed tax rates to not just be held low, but actually to come down. And I think it's very important to note that the base broadening they did was so extensive in that proposal that they also included raising capital gains and dividend tax rates to the same rate as labor income. And no Republican would support that. And so to claim that, all we have to do is broaden the base and we can can actually afford to lower rates, it ignores the fact that they're not really willing to broaden the base enough to do that.
Bob, you heard Dick Durbin there, Democrat, saying protect these deductions. But is that just, do you see that as posturing? And the president's talking about going for some revenue in this quarter.
Well, one thing we know about negotiations is everybody wants to hold as hard a position as firmly as possible for as long as possible. If you look like you're not going to give in, you may have a chance to bring the other guy closer to your side. I think what's going to happen is what's happening behind closed doors now between the aides to these various individuals. They're the ones doing the negotiations about exactly what are we going to trade off this for that, how are we going to come up with something. And as I said earlier, I think we're going to see something come forth that will be fully formed. It will be a package that both sides have said, yeah, we're going to take a hit, but we're going to get something out of it. And then it's a matter of Speaker Boehner going back to the Republicans in the House and selling it to them, for the president to sell it to his side, both Senate, in particular the Senate, and get enough support so they can get it through. But I think we're not going to know ahead of time exactly what's happening, because each side, for public purposes, is going to hold to as strong a line as possible.
And then do the deal, and then trot it out, and then watch us. I don't know. All hell breaks loose, or we'll see. Joe in Texas, Marfa, Texas. Joe, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Let's call this what it really is for the middle class. It's welfare. When you look up in Webster's Dictionary, I just looked it up, the second definition is aiding people who, with money. Well, the middle class continues to blame these problems on the poor. The poor don't pay taxes. So let's call it what it really is. Instead of loopholes and everything else, you know, when you get an IRA deduction, and by the way, you can trade stocks in an IRA and never have to pay the tax on dividends until you retire, and medical expenses and taking care of your mom at home.
But what do you say to Americans, Joe, who say these are the things that have made America middle-class life possible?
But look, that's the point. Let's call it what it is, and let's add up how much money does the middle class get a break on, get welfare on, for all the deductions that they're able to take, that they're complaining that the problem is welfare. By the way, the welfare is also unemployment insurance.
Mm.
So how about the deductions that you get, standard deductions if you have five kids?
Yeah, you know,
well,
yeah,
that.
Joe, we got it. Bob, you see Joe's point here. He says, look, stop moaning. This has been a kind of a subsidy for the middle class. But at the same time, it's been baked into the budgets of the middle class. Should we be looking the other way, look on down the scale? Is that really where the pain's been? Has this helped keep the poor poor? Bob?
Uh-oh.
Oh, I don't know if Bob's there. What do you say, Diane?
Am I there?
Yes, you're on, Bob. What do you say?
Okay, take you back on. I think the point that Joe makes is absolutely right. We have a lot of social welfare done through the tax system, and that's one of the things.
Oh, that line's breaking out. Diane, what do you say?
Yeah, we do a lot of spending. Government does a lot of spending through the tax code. I think the point is that, it's very hard to think about. I think tax expenditures, what economists call tax expenditures, which are spending through the tax code, I think that it's a lot easier to cut spending in the tax side of the budget in a progressive manner where the rich are burdened more than the poor than it is to cut spending on the direct spending side of the budget. I think that's important to note. It's like none of these things that we're talking about as ways to reduce the deficit in the future are fun. They're all painful. They're all tough choices. It's not just cutting waste, fraud, and abuse. And so the question is, where can we cut spending cut tax subsidies, and do the least harm both to the economy and to the households in the middle to lower class that can least afford to have these benefits cut.
Let's go to Steve in Providence, Rhode Island. Steve, you're on the air. What do you think?
Yes, Tom. I think there's a couple of things going on here. One is I think we got the cart before the horse with a lot of folks, and I think we're ignoring what the election results said. And if you continued to do polls of the American people, what the American people would say, and that is, in general, raise taxes on the very wealthy. We can get the revenue targets that we need pretty much out of going back to the Clinton rates. Let's remember that just 12 years ago, we were generating surpluses under the Clinton rates. Yes, a complex tax code. Yes, maybe long range. We want to do some tweaking of deductions and all that.
Yep.
That gets into a bunch of landmines that we don't need to try to address in the next 4 weeks or even 6 months.
Let us pick it up right there, Steve. Diane, what about it? Just go back to Clinton-era tax rates. The country did fine, and don't get into this hornet's nest.
Right. I mean, it is definitely a lot easier to change tax rates, especially when what we're talking about is actually going back to the old tax rates. So in terms of the fiscal cliff negotiations from now until the end of the year, I don't think we have to worry that Congress is going to agree on some package of reducing tax preferences between now and then. It's much more likely that what they agree on is some compromise position on the rates and some promise to do something more on regarding tax reform and reducing some of the tax preferences in the future.
But it's a compromise there. Steve says, just raise the rates. We did all right before. Why get into this? If I may, David in Nashville, our time grows short. But David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
The elephant in the room is corporate tax rates on the one hand and corporate loopholes on the other. The elephant in the room has not been discussed. It's not being discussed until now in this conversation.
Yeah.
GE paid no income taxes last year, and Apple paid at 2% rate. That's corporate welfare. How much revenue, if this were a level playing field with personal income taxes, how much revenue would be gained, and what would be the feared unintended consequences?
Let's look at that. Bob Williams, how about it? The caller says, why are we looking at individual tax breaks? Let's look at corporate tax breaks and loopholes. Why not go there instead, Bob?
You could go there, but I think there's a lot of opposition on the Republican side, again, to going after corporate rates. The biggest problem on the corporate side is it's small potatoes compared to the individual tax. We bring in about $200 billion a year from the corporate tax. We bring in about $1 trillion a year from the income tax. So you'd have to do a lot bigger change to get the same kinds of revenues. And I don't think it's on the table right now. I think it could be on the table. It should be on the table. It will be on the table if we have tax reform. But for the next 6 weeks, it's not part of the bargain.
I mean, we heard the president talking all through the campaign about tax breaks for big oil companies and all the rest. You can see why our caller might say, wait a minute, what happened to that?
And two-thirds of corporations pay no income tax. It's not just the GEs and the Apples paying low rates. Two-thirds of corporations pay nothing. And that's for a whole bunch of reasons, part carry forward losses, partly that a lot of them don't make any money. But it's just not the place we're going to go in the short run. I think we can have this conversation later, but for right now, I think the focus is going to be on the individual tax.
Wow, but point fully taken to our caller, Allison, Portland, Tennessee. Allison, thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think that everyone ought to be willing to make sacrifices. We should stop talking about who is going to make sacrifices to make our country get back on track. I voted Republican, and I tend toward different sides, but I think that the biggest deal is just trying to get everybody to where they're helping to bail out our country. This isn't an issue of, well, you know, the rich don't want to give money and the middle class shouldn't have to give more money, but everybody's going to need to make some kind of a sacrifice to make this work.
So what do you say then, as having voted Republican, what do you think about the opposition to raising rates on the higher income earners? Do you agree with Republican representatives on that front at this point, Allison, or not? How do you look at that?
No, I really don't. I think that everybody, especially the people who have more money, ought to be willing to give money to make us a successful country. I mean, we are in a lower middle income bracket, and we would be willing to take a major cut in order to see our country not fall apart in the next 5 years.
Allison, there's a stand-up American making her view known. I appreciate your call. And one more, Jay in Worthington, Massachusetts. Jay, our time is short. What do you say?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm not part of the 1%, but I'm probably part of the 2 or 3%.
Okay.
Every time I do my taxes, I'm astonished at the benefits that come to me that I never asked for. I would be happy to pay more capital gains tax. 15% is ridiculous. I'd be happy to go back to the Clinton-era tax rates and also the Clinton-era defense budget. You know, the playing field is absolutely not level. The people who have the most complain the loudest. I would rather pay more taxes, frankly, than watch the stock market tank because the government, once again, doesn't come to a decision.
Jay, we've got it, and I appreciate your call and your sentiment as well. Diane, How do you think this is going to play out? Will we see a puff of smoke sometime before January 1st or before Christmas that says we've got a deal, details to follow? When are we going to know what's really on the chopping block?
I don't think we're going to see a lot of chopping block stuff happen before the end of the year. I think that there will be some agreement that lets us avoid the worst parts of the cliff, and that there'll be some plan, some compromise agreement for a framework in the future that will keep revenues, bring in more revenues and keep spending a little bit lower, too.
Bob, do you share that confidence in the, 4 weeks ahead?
I think they'll come to some compromise, but I don't think it's going to be a grand bargain that solves our problems. A lot of that will be kicked down the road. We'll have to deal with it again next year.
Well, we have got everybody's antenna up as to what may be on the table as the old chopper, the chopping knives fly around. Robert and Williams at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center, we're very grateful to you for being with us today. Thank you so much for joining us, Bob.
It was my pleasure. I enjoyed it.
And Diane Lim, Chief Economist with the Concord Coalition, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, tune in tomorrow. We'll have the whole week of news in review. Great to have you with us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.